Google search to uncover what is already on our website and said in countless national media interviews. But thank you for airing our perfect conversation, emphasizing our policy work is totally separate from the Trump campaign, as we have been saying, she said. Your response, Lawrence Carter.
Yeah, they would say that, wouldn't they? It's clear from the recordings that they are actively seeking to keep this stuff secret. So again, going back to the comments from their research director, Mika Meadowcroft, they don't want people to know what's in these plans. They don't want them to know what they're working on. And so what we found was that they're seeking to keep it secret from the American public ahead of the election. They don't want people to see this before they vote. But crucially, the actual details of how they're going to go about doing these things, you know, we now know that there's 350 documents. Mika Meadowcroft said there's a big stack of them waiting to be handed into transition teams. The other crucial thing that we've kind of established, which is kind of very much not what they're saying publicly, is that there's this very strong relationship with both the Trump campaign and Donald Trump himself. You know, Project 2025 has insisted it's separate from the Trump operation. The Trump campaign has disavowed Project 2025. But here we have Russell Vogt. He oversaw the GOP platform. He's a former Trump cabinet member. He told us he speaks with Trump regularly. He's writing the party platform for this year's election, whilst at the same time overseeing this kind of pipeline of documents, blueprints for the next administration as part of Project 2025. And that's certainly not something that they would talk about in public. So, yeah.
Very interesting. Kevin Roberts, the head of the Heritage Foundation, has this new book coming out, Dawn's Early Light, Taking Back Washington to Save America, with a foreword by none other than President Trump's vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance. Politico writes, J.D. Vance, the Republican vice presidential nominee, has written the foreword to the forthcoming book. In March, Roberts told Politico Senator Vance was, quote, absolutely going, it was absolutely going to be one of the leaders, if not the leader, of our movement. After Vance was named as Trump's running mate, Roberts said the Heritage Foundation had been privately, quote, really rooting for him to be the pick. Even though Trump's campaign, of course, has disavowed any connection to Project 2025. Lawrence.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of also borne out by our conversations with Russell Vogt and Mika Meadowcroft. You know, they're very excited about the J.D. Vance pick, and it's because they see him as one of them. And so, yeah. They've got, like, Vogt's got a very good relationship with Trump. He's got a great relationship with the Trump campaign. You know, he's been actively collaborating with the Trump campaign on earned media hits, for example, which the Trump campaign sought to convey what a second Trump term would look like. They had Russell Vogt speak to the media for them to articulate that. And he spoke to the Time magazine, for example, about his work on Project 2025. So, there's that, those strong relationships already there, but then you have, you know, the J.D. Vance pick. He's literally one of them as far as they see it, and they're excited about it.
And the views of Project 2025 when it comes to and Vogt's views on abortion, on marriage equality, Lawrence Carter?
Yeah, so again, the findings were that, they, for example, on abortion, they saw that their goal is ultimately a national ban. They're pragmatic. Like, Russell Vogt is a pragmatic member of Project 2025, and he sees that, in his words, that would mean electoral annihilation for Trump if he committed to that. So actually, their strategy is to kind of go after abortion by kind of more executive powers, like, for example, if he was reappointed to the Office for Management and Budget, blocking that funding for Planned Parenthood. Again, like, he talked about marriage equality in terms of, this is kind of a fight that we need to start having, but it's one that they're further behind in compared to abortion. But the goal, again, is to kind of end marriage equality. Similarly, kind of, they're pursuing various strategies to try and ban pornography. So, yeah, it's kind of it's quite a kind of radical agenda from the kind of social conservatism point of view, but Russell Vought is certainly on the end of the spectrum of kind of what is politically possible, rather than kind of, I guess, the more Heritage Foundation approach, which is kind of more absolutist.
Lawrence Garter, I want to thank you for being with us, founder and director of the Center for Climate Reporting. We'll link to your new investigation, Undercover in Project 2025, the secret of second phase and the radical policies set for rollout on day one. Next up, the World Health Organization declares Mpox a global public health emergency as the first cases of Mpox outside Africa are confirmed. We'll get an update from Nigeria. Stay with us.
And I want you here with me.
Inspiration by Chicago. Tune in all next week as Democracy Now! Does a special 2-hour daily broadcast August 19th to the 23rd from the convention called Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We look now at the spread of the Mpox virus, as the first cases outside Africa have now been confirmed in Pakistan and Sweden. The World Health Organization has declared a global health emergency after an outbreak of the viral disease in the Democratic Republic of the Congo also spread to a dozen other African countries. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the threat of cross-border spread remains high.
It's clear that a coordinated international response is essential to stop these outbreaks and save lives. A public health emergency of international concern is the highest level of alarm under international health law.
This is the second time the World Health Organization issues a public health emergency over Mpox since a outbreak in 2022 of a different version of the virus, which at the time infected nearly 100,000 people in over 100 nations. Earlier this week, the Africa Centers for Disease Control declared a public health emergency as well. So far this year, Africa CDC has logged over 15,000 suspected cases of Mpox, formerly known as monkeypox, which can cause fever, rashes, and extremely painful lesions. It often spreads through close, intimate physical contact. Scientists say the new strain of Mpox is more lethal, with a fatality rate of around 5% in adults, double that in children. Jean Kaseya is Director General of the Africa CDC.
This is not just an African issue. Mpox is a global threat, a menace that knows no boundaries, no race, no creed. It is a virus that exploits our vulnerabilities, preying on our weakest point.
The Africa CDC said in May it was struggling to secure any of the millions of doses of Mpox vaccine it requested from drug companies. For more, we go to the capital of Nigeria, to Abuja, where we're joined by Zubeda Baba Ibrahim, Nigerian journalist and sub-editor at Nigeria Health Watch, where her new piece is headlined, Mpox Vaccine, Africa's Wait Continues 2 Years After Global Outbreak. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Zubeda Baba Ibrahim. Can you talk about the vaccine, the difficulty in getting it, and what Mpox means for Africa?
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show. So, the situation is quite dire, even though it's still developing as more countries are confirming cases. But I just wanted to say that while Mpox is something that people hear once in a blue moon, in West and Central Africa, where it is endemic. It is something that has been reoccurring for years. So first of all, I'll just go back to some sort of history for Nigeria, where I am now. So back in 2017, when the mpox virus reemerged in Nigeria, in the southwest region of Nigeria, so there was a lot of call for the African Union to weigh in on it, because it had just reemerged after decades, and people saw that there were a lot of research gaps about what it is, how to handle it. And Nigeria sounded the alarm to a lot of partners, a lot of international partners that could weigh in. But at the point, the calls were unheard, right? So, and it has been an outbreak year in, year out. We have seen an outbreak with confirmed cases, confirmed deaths, and nobody took this call serious till in 2022, where it became a global outbreak. So, and then since then, it has been, there's nothing, but in endemic regions, we still had those confirmed cases, and a lot of people also died from it. And while it is now declared again a global health threat and a public health emergency of international concern, which is good, and I feel like it is timely, but at the same time, it is not timely, because does it have to be that other countries outside Africa confirming cases before we take this decision? When do we become proactive about it? So currently in Nigeria, there has been 39 cases, which has been confirmed yesterday evening. And the Nigerian CDC has said that it is still trying to get 10,000 doses of the vaccine. But 10,000 doses is quite small for a large population that are at the threat of the outbreak. So let me ask you,
Zubeda, is the vaccine available for free, and who makes it? Why is it so difficult to get?
So, yes, that is one of the questions I also have. The vaccine is manufactured by two organizations that we know. And one is in Germany, and I think one is in the U.S. I'm not really sure, but there are two manufacturers of it. So, and it's something that Africa could have weighed in, right, and get the vaccines before the outbreak, or before it became this big, or before it came this big in 2022. So currently, the WHO has said it like months ago that there would be vaccines, but it is still not available. Yes, the vaccines are supposed to be free so that everyone can get the jabs as soon as possible and for the prevention, but we still do not know what are the timelines to get these vaccines. I mean, even in DRC, where the virus is quite endemic and happens all year round, every year, they still do not have access to the vaccine. And it's a matter of, okay, do Africa leaders partner with some local manufacturers to get these vaccines, or do we still wait? Do we still continue to be at the back of the queue for vaccine access?
I want to go to a clip from the Democratic Republic of Congo, which alone has reported more than 15,000 mpox cases and over 500 deaths, most of them among children under 15. Meanwhile, health officials warning of the spread of mpox across crowded camps for displaced people. This is the mother of a 7-year-old child who contracted mpox in one of the displacement camps near Goma.
My daughter Grace had caught the skin lesion disease. I took her to the hospital, where the doctors took good care of her and she recovered. And I don't know how or by whom my child had been contaminated. I just watched helplessly as the symptoms appeared on her body.
So Zubeda Baba Ibrahim, what are you calling for now?
First of all, we need to decolonize global health, where we're not just waiting for vaccines for somewhere else to come to Africa. We need to like be proactive. This is more of our issue because this is endemic, like I said, in West and Central parts of Africa, but is now spreading to more parts of Africa. So we need to wake up. Our African leaders need to wake up and realize that this is dire and it needs proactive measures. I also want not just like the vaccine to be accessible, but for communities to know what mpox is. So I feel like if it was the case of chickenpox or measles, a lot of parents or a lot of people in the community can identify that this is chickenpox and these are the measures I can take. So while we wait for the vaccines, these are things that we need to consider, empowering communities to know that, okay, this is the symptoms. So like the mother in DRC said, she did not know who contracted her daughter. And these are some of the issues that we have where people do not have access to knowledge on what is mpox, what are the different variants. This is what I do when the symptoms are manifesting in my households and stuff like that. So, but a lot of organizations are working on informing people and to curb misinformation, because with outbreaks, there are always misinformations. And so
I'm looking at your article, Zubeda. You write, in 2022, the United States built a stockpile of approximately 20 million doses of the Jynneos vaccine, a dual-purpose smallpox and mpox vaccine. Your final comment. We just have 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah. About the stockpile, I think if countries have stockpiles of these Jynneos vaccine, they should start administering it before it reaches their doorstep. So this is like a proactive measure everyone can take. And then the countries can also build border management, increase surveillance, and like I said, prevent.
Zubeda Baba Ibrahim, thank you so much for being with us. Nigerian journalist, sub-editor at Nigeria Health Watch. We'll link to your new piece, Mpox Vaccine, Africa's Wait Continues 2 Years After Global Outbreak. Next up, has the mystery of the Baltic Sea attack been solved nearly 2 years after the Nord Stream pipelines were blown up that carried Russian gas to Europe? Germany has a warrant out for the arrest of a Ukrainian national. We'll speak with the German reporter who broke the story. Back in 20 seconds.
Riders on the storm, riders on the storm, into this house we're born. Into this world.
Riders on the Storm by The Doors. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at how a top advisor to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has denied a report in the Wall Street Journal that his government approved a plan to blow up the Nord Stream pipelines nearly 2 years ago, in September of 2022. A six-member crew of Ukrainian civilians and active-duty soldiers reportedly used a rented yacht, satellite navigation, sonar, and seabed maps to reach the Nord Stream pipelines on the bottom of the Baltic Sea, then divers used an explosive and timer-controlled detonators to rupture the pipelines, triggering a massive release of methane gas. The blast severed 3 of the 4 pipelines that carried Russian gas to Europe. President Zelensky reportedly approved the plan, but later tried to stop it after a Dutch intelligence agency learned of the plot and told the CIA. But his commander-in-chief at the time, Valery Zaluzhny, forged ahead despite Zelensky's U-turn. This comes as Poland says it was unable to carry out an arrest warrant issued by Germany for a new suspect in the investigation into the Nord Stream attack, a 44-year-old Ukrainian diving professional identified as Volodymyr Z, who's alleged to have attached explosive charges to the pipelines. Polish authorities say the suspect fled to Ukraine in July. For more, we're joined in Berlin by Holger Stark, deputy editor-in-chief and head of the investigative team at Germany's biggest weekly, Die Zeit. He co-wrote this new exclusive report, Has the Mystery of the Baltic Sea Attack Been Solved?, as well as last year's deep dive headlined Who Blew Up Nord Stream? Welcome to Democracy Now, Holger. Can you just lay out what you found? We summarized your results.
Good morning, Amy, and thanks for having me. Yes, we know after almost 2 year long investigation now that at least one Ukrainian citizen is highly suspected to be a part of this six-people crew that blew up Nord Stream. He is a father of a son. He was born in Kiev. He is an engineer by training, but also served in the Ukrainian army. We know that he is a patriot. He posted on Facebook together with his colleagues a highly patriotic Ukrainian post that he would defend until death his home country. And his traces were found by German investigators. He was brought by a shuttle service, a driver from Ukraine, from Kiev, over Poland, via Poland, to Germany. A speed camera, funnily, made a photo of that transport crew. He was identified on that photo as well. So the German authorities are deeply convinced that he was on that sailing boat. He probably had a special role in that attack because he is a highly skilled diver. He's capable of operating in the depth of 240 feet, which is only something that a few divers are capable of. It needs special training, special expertise. And remember, those pipelines of Nord Stream were in a depth of exactly that 240 feet in the Baltic Sea. So he probably was one of the guys who dove down to the bottom of the Baltic Sea and was bringing the charge to the pipelines.
And if you can explain who investigated in terms of countries, Sweden and Denmark, both leading investigations into the blast, but closed them. And yet you have Germany, you're in Berlin, which continued. And you are now reporting what you think are their findings.
Yes, it was initially a four-country investigation, Denmark and Sweden. You've mentioned that. The Netherlands also investigated, and of course Germany, because it disrupted the gas transport pipeline between Russia and Germany, and also this sailing boat departed from a German harbor. No, it's only the German investigation. Everything else is closed. The Germans merged all forensic indications. In June, they came to the conclusion that this is enough, that they probably were able to identify at least parts of that crew. They went to a court and obtained that arrest warrant. They hoped significantly to get hold of that guy who used to live in a suburb of Warsaw, the capital of Poland. So in June, they transferred the arrest warrant to the Polish government. They also spoke on the highest levels of the government to the government in Poland, and were really hoping that the Polish authorities would arrest the 44-year-old diver. He then disappeared in July suddenly, and the saying in Berlin is that there's a high plausibility that someone within the Polish authorities, the Polish government, tipped off the guy. Remember, the old Polish government, who used to be in charge last year, was highly in support of Ukraine, and there were a lot of people, including the government, who said those guys who blew up Nord Stream, they are heroes and not criminals.
I want to go to President Biden. In February of 2022, he holds a news conference, a joint one with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and Biden brings up the future of the Nord Stream pipeline.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
We promise you we'll be able to do it. Now, I should correct, this is from 2021. Russia invades Ukraine in February of 2022. Your response?
Well, you can read this in two ways. You can read this in a threat of military action, but also you can read it in a sense of a political action, diplomatic pressure. And I mean, we all remember those days, starting with the Trump administration, by the way, where the U.S. Government clearly wanted the Germans to stop with that project, to stop Nord Stream as a pipeline, because that pipeline bypassed Ukraine. It made Ukraine dispensable. It was a direct connection between Russia and Germany. It was a direct trade of gas between the two countries. And it started within the Trump administration that they executed a lot of power, diplomatic pressure on Germany. So did the Biden administration in the beginning. But also have in mind, Amy, that later on, President Biden released the sanctions pressure against Germany. He cut some kind of political deal with the German government, especially with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Those two guys got along really well. And I read it the way that Biden said, when it comes to the worst, when Russia is indeed invading Ukraine, we will make sure with our German partners that this gas transport is no longer existing. So it's not a threat of military action, in my opinion, but a threat to use any diplomatic means to stop that.
So we only have 2 minutes left, but I wanted you to lay out what you understand happened and also respond to the Ukrainian President Zelensky, who says this isn't true.
I think the picture is quite clear 2 years after the attack. There was a group of Ukrainians who were willing to risk their lives to stop that pipeline. Everybody in Ukraine would consider them to be heroes. So they had a chain of command within the Ukrainian military. They went up that chain. The operation was authorized at least probably by General Zelensky at that time, the head of the Ukrainian army. And we just don't know at the end how far up in that chain the whole project went. There are two different versions. One is that President Zelensky was left out intentionally for plausible deniability, but it would be enough that the head of the army authorized the operation. And the second scenario says that Zelensky was in the loop, but after CIA executed some pressure on the Ukrainian army, he stepped back and tried to stop the plot. The commander was already on its way, and it was impossible to stop the operation happening. But in both scenarios, it is an Ukrainian operation. It is within Ukrainians' responsibility, and it raises significant political questions. Germany is a second biggest supporter of Ukraine, no doubt about that. But this attack must be debated on a political level as well.
And what about the other suspects, Holger?
Well, we know at least some descriptions about the guys. We have some photos of them. We have some false names. But I'm pretty convinced that German investigators will find out at the end who was on board of that sailing yacht. We might not be able to solve that mystery at the end politically, but I'm quite sure that we will, after some time, know who exactly executed that attack, who was the perpetrators.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Holger Stark, Deputy Editor-in-Chief, head of the investigative team at Germany's biggest weekly, Die Zeit. He wrote their new exclusive report, "Has the Mystery of the Baltic Sea Attack Been Solved?" That does it for our show. Tune in all next week, August 19th to the 23rd, as Democracy Now! Broadcasts from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. We're expanding to 2 hours daily. We also have job openings at Democracy Now!, currently accepting applications for director of development, support our fundraising efforts, and archives intern. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Prime Minister and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is the place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
You are listening.